Hello and welcome to Beyond the Diagnosis, a show where we break down the barriers of medical science and simplify the jargon for your understanding. I am Dr. Viroshini Harikrishnan, a health strategist, and with me, my co-host, Dr. Ashish Philip, an orthopedic surgeon. Today, with Women's Day around the corner, we have a very special show for you about infertility. We are going to look at its causes, how it could be treated, and hopefully with all of this, you have a better understanding of what has been plaguing you. Ashish, do you mind introducing our guest for today?
Thank you, Dr. Viroshini, and a very happy Women's Day to all our listeners across the globe. And with that, today we have with us a very special guest, Dr. Smriti Nayak, who is an accomplished obstetrician and gynecologist with over 10 years of experience in conducting normal deliveries, cesarean sections, and laparoscopic surgeries. She has also specialized in reproductive medicine. A thorough clinician, Dr. Smriti has performed over 1,000 oocyte retrieval procedures with great success and has helped numerous couples conceive through IUI and IVF procedures with individualized treatment strategies. Thank you, Dr. Smriti, for joining us today on this very, very special show.
Thank you, Dr. Ashish, for that lovely introduction. I'm so happy to be here. It's truly a great pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Smriti, I want to welcome you to our show, and I want to thank you for doing something so, so simple yet important, which is enlighten us about something as mystical and as over-informed as infertility. If I can just pick your brains a little. Could you just make us understand very, very simply, what is infertility?
So a textbook definition of infertility is when a couple is unable to conceive after having had unprotected intercourse for up to 1 year. So this is a definition for younger couples. And when it comes to a patient who is a little more than 35 years of age, we bring it down to 6 months of duration. Yeah. So when a couple has tried in the ovulatory period without using protection for up to a year and still has not been able to conceive, that is known as infertility.
So if a young couple, and I would like to assume young here is below 40, or is there an age limit that we should be looking at?
Absolutely. In our setup back here in India, the young couple would be somewhere between 25 to 30. Because that is the average age.
Understood.
At which people get married and start trying for pregnancy. Anything about 35 would be a little above the age limit of, you know, of the definition of a young couple.
Understood. And for anyone above the age of 35, continuous unprotected sex within the correct ovulatory period with no pregnancy or them not conceiving within 6 months, that's considered as infertility.
Yes. The reason for this slight adjustment in the duration is because we do know that women above 35 years of age have a different clinical scenario, like they have a decreased ovarian reserve. So for the want of saving time, we don't want them to keep trying for 6 more months without having any investigation or intervention. And that is the reason we tell couples that they can try for 6 months, but if they've still not conceived, then it is better to come down to a fertility clinic and get assessed rather than wasting 6 more months of time and just coming at the end of 1 year, which is actually the definition. So, you know, you don't have to always stick to the book.
Do you feel that there is all of a sudden there is a rise in infertility? Because I think I've started to hear this more, probably maybe because, you know, we are in that age group or past that age group where, you know, people are trying to have kids. So I don't know if it's just relevant to what I am going through my phase of my life, or is it that, you know, there is an increase in incidence now as compared to before, probably the 90s or 80s. What do you think about that?
Yes, absolutely. So back when I was doing my fellowship, there were not so many infertility cases that we would see. Maybe 1 in 10 couples would be suffering from infertility. That was what the statistic was. But over the past few years, especially, you know, post the pandemic, you can say it has reduced to 1 in 6 to 8 couples. So 1 in every 6 couple trying to conceive and suffering from infertility is quite a staggering number. And it has increased over the past few years because of multiple reasons. The most common being late marriage. People are choosing to decide on when they want to get married. They want to give some time to choose the partner. So they get married a little later than the normal age range that used to be prevalent. Apart from that, they also decide to start a family a little later on. So considering these two choices that women are taking in their own hands, there is a slight increase in the cases of infertility. Apart from this, there is also the lifestyle. That is, I would say, the crux of the problem here, both in terms of male as well as female infertility, because we know that lifestyle plays a very, very important role when it comes to reproductive health.
I understand what you're saying. I think our parents have always been, you know, as soon as you get married, most of your parents want you to get married when you're younger. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you're married, they're like, where's that baby? Where's that baby? You know, so that's the added pressure to it also, you know, but can you help me understand what really changes when a person is aging that they're not able to conceive faster than they were able to when they were younger? Is there any pathology?
Yes. So all of us women are born with a fixed number of eggs in our ovaries. They end up decreasing with time. So with every menstrual cycle that a girl gets, there are a certain number of eggs that are recruited, out of which just one forms the dominant follicle, which is responsible for a pregnancy. So in that cycle, if they're not tried for pregnancy, or, you know, they don't want to get pregnant, so the egg gets deteriorated and whatever recruited follicles are there get degenerated. So for that cycle, you would say around 3 to 4 eggs are depleted from the ovary. So the beginning of our menarche, that is when a girl starts having her period, the number of eggs are around 15 to 20,000.
Oh.
So this is the number of eggs that she will have, that is until she reaches menopause. So with every cycle, certain number of eggs get depleted. So by the time she reaches 35 to 40, the eggs have come to a very low range. And finally, at the age of 45, when there are no eggs left in the ovary, that is when she hits menopause.
I went through whole of medical school and never, ever figured that one out. Wow.
Yeah, same.
That was intuitive. I mean, a lot of women don't really understand. I mean, you know, like I was saying, our parents would always say, you know, you have to have a child at a younger age, but we don't understand what the real problem is. So that really helps understand. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that we should know about is that the rate at which the eggs get depleted in Asians is much faster than the white counterparts. When we have this tradition that you already mentioned, you know, why the parents always insisted on getting married sooner and having kids sooner, probably there was some sort of knowledge there that, you know, by the end of 30 to 35, the number of eggs that we'll have will be less compared to our Caucasian counterparts. So it's very important that we do not compare ourselves to any other race and say that, okay, when they can do it, why not us?
Dr. Smithy, you know, so far we've only spoken about how women have got finite number of oocytes and stuff like that. Can we sort of expand on what happens to their partners, their husbands, the male counterpart? I'm sure there is male infertility that goes unspoken. I'm sure the furnace of stress comes in as well. And yes, it's obvious men can be fathers even at the age of 100. But I'm sure there is a depletion or a reduction in the quality of the sperms. How does this complement one another? If two partners, a husband and wife, both lead equally stressful lives and both choose to consciously delay having kids to a later age, aren't they both at risk of being infertile in some way?
So when it comes to male infertility, there has been a global spermageddon. So we are seeing a decrease in the sperm count and the motility as well as morphology. So there are few parameters that we check when it comes to the semen analysis. Now, men are known to delay their visits to the doctor. At least here in India, when we see couples coming into the clinic, they usually come, just the wife, you know, they come in first and the husband refuses to take any tests, or they actually, you know, say that there's nothing wrong with them. So that sort of a stigma is actually quite challenging to get over. But with age, there is a definite effect on male fertility as well, but not as much as how much age has an impact on the female factors.
Understood.
For men, they can reproduce up until even the age of 40 to 45, but there is a decrease in the quality of the sperms. So there are chances of abortions in the pregnancy because of the genetic component, which will not be the healthiest. It's the same with women as well. But for men, a very common fact which is known is that the semen analysis or the report keeps changing. You know, it's not something which is very fixed. For instance, for a woman, if her ovarian reserve is less, it is less in the sense that it can't increase or it can't suddenly change over a period of few months. But for men, on the other hand, if their counts are low and they decide to do some lifestyle changes, reduce stress, reduce smoking, and do certain things to help improve the count, then over a period of 3 to 6 months, we see a significant change in the improvement of the semen analysis.
Understood. So, Dr. Smiti, you're saying that some are modifiable risks, some are not. So, are we saying that infertility is a lot more forgiving for men?
Yeah.
So once you modify the risk factors, men can go back to having good quality sperm. But then women, no matter how you look at it, it's unfortunate. We get the short end of the stick and we've got limited number of oocytes to run with. That's very heartbreaking, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a harsh truth.
Understood.
So that was very interesting, Dr. Smriti. But these are, I think, a few of the most common pathologies. But are there other causes around? Because I always keep hearing the word PCOD attached to infertility a lot. So endometriosis and stuff like that. So can you throw some more light about what are the other causes which are there? And are those also treatable?
Right. So PCOD or PCOS, you know, there are two different acronyms. A lot of the times people think they're very different entities, but to be honest, it's pretty much the same. PCOS stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome, and PCOD stands for polycystic ovarian disease. So when it comes to PCOS, that is a syndrome. So it will include a certain spectrum of disorders, which will include cysts in the ovary. So it's quite self-explanatory, right? Poly is multiple. Cysts are the ones pertaining to the ovary. And so PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. So PCOD is where the cysts are seen in the ovary only, right? We don't see any other abnormalities. But when we talk about PCOS, it will also include certain other pathologies, like they will have increased androgen, increased testosterone in their biochemical parameters, and they will have clinical symptoms of irregular cycles, increased hair growth in the face area or the chin area. They'll have loss of hair. They may also have obesity. And with this, they will have an ultrasound finding of cysts in the ovary. So this is in a short way to describe PCOS.
I think this is really interesting and we're starting to wrap our heads around it. Let's just take a break over here and then come back and we'll talk more about this on the other side.
Every day, whether you're running, taking a walk, traveling, stuck in traffic, or just doing nothing, tune into the Old Couple Podcast for great company every fortnight on your favorite podcast network, a Pandemia Inc. production.
Hello and welcome back, everyone. Today we have with us Dr. Smiti. We are talking about infertility. This is a special edition for Women's Day. Dr. Smiti, when we had taken a break earlier, we spoke about PCOS or PCOD. Could you maybe tell us, what are we really not paying attention to? We tend to be very, very focused on the infertility part of it. I feel there's something that we're not really addressing in terms of long tail effects of PCOS. Could you please walk us through that?
Okay, great question. So this is something I've always wanted to address to most of my patients who come in trying to conceive. And so once they conceive and have a baby and all of that is done, it's not like the PCOD goes away. Right, they still have to live with it. And unless they take care of it, most commonly what is seen is that they end up with diabetes because there is increased insulin resistance noted in patients of PCOS. Apart from that, they can also end up with certain cardiovascular disorders because they will be having dyslipidemia. They'll have lipid disorders because of which they can end up with even heart attacks at a younger age. Apart from this, the most important complication that they should know about is endometrial cancer. So in PCOD, they do not get period for up to 2 months or 3 months. So that just means that the endometrium is getting accumulated inside the uterus without getting shed. And that can lead to changes in the endometrial lining, which can be cancerous. So it's very important that every girl should bleed once in every 2 months, like approximately 6 times a year, at least with some sort of withdrawal bleeding, which can be, you know, taken once you consult a gynecologist. They will give you some pills because of which there can be a bleeding which is induced in patients of PCOD who will have irregular cycles. For whatever reason, if they keep having a lot of irregularity in the cycles and spotting or very thick endometrial lining in the ultrasound scan, it's important to get an endometrial biopsy done, which is a very simple outpatient procedure. And this will let us know if there are any signs of endometrial cancer in the biopsy result. So that way you can be one step ahead instead of waiting for the disease to spread and get to know about it only at a very late stage.
And how is it different from a pap smear? Because we keep hearing the word pap smear a lot, right? So
pap smear is a screening test for cervical cancer. Now, pap smear is also very, very important tool to screen for cervical cancer. What's interesting is that cervical cancer is the only cancer which is caused because of a virus, and it can be vaccine prevented. So a lot of women out there want to get the vaccine in, and we are also promoting it very actively. There are multiple vaccines available in the market to prevent cervical cancer. And pap smear is just one of the tools which can be used to screen for looking for cells of the cervical cancer. It's a very simple outpatient procedure. It's absolutely painless, and it's done in a period of 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, and then you can go home. The reports are ready in 2 to 3 days, and you'll get to know if your pap smear is normal or it's showing any abnormal cells.
Dr. Smithy, you spoke to us about the long-term effects of PCOD. This is severely misunderstood. Is there an opportunity for us to prevent PCOD? Is there a genetic predisposition, or are there just environmental factors? What are the things that we are not paying attention to? And with that, could you also talk to us a little bit about the treatment?
Yes, absolutely. Prevention of PCOS is a question I come across a lot. And the number one on that list would be lifestyle modifications. We know that our lifestyle has a huge impact on our health. And the main reason for that is we are what we eat, as well as the amount of exercise that is done on a daily basis. So when it comes to the diet, I would say the diet has a huge role to play with PCOD. Apart from that, the exercise that somebody does, when we talk about exercise, most of our patients just say they walk for 30 minutes, you know, just do some yoga for maybe 20 or 30 minutes. But I think a good exercise regime would include HIIT, which is your high intensity training. And that should mean that your heart rate increases to like 130 to 140 beats per minute. And you really like, you know, sweat it out. And that would actually make you lose weight, burn calories. So again, coming to exercise, when it comes to the body weight, it's very important to not always gauge whether your exercises are working out or not with only the weight. You have to calculate your BMI, that is the body mass index, and try to come into the normal range. So your body mass index has to be between 20 to 24.9. So anything less than 20 will fall into the, you know, extremely thin and anorexic range. Anything above 25 to 29.9 will be overweight. Anything above 30 to 34.9 is obese. And above 35 is categorized as morbidly obese. So most of my patients, you know, they get very disappointed because they have not lost weight, but then they would have lost inches. So that is also a good thing, you know. Some people are just generally, they have a wide frame, they have a lot of bone weight, you can say. So if you can like run 5 kilometers in 45 minutes, that is amazing. You know, it doesn't matter. You may be a little bit on the heavier side, but exercise has to be tailored, you know, customized. So always find what works out for you. You can just pursue dance, you can go play a game of badminton, any sort of exercise which gets your heart rate up and pumping and gives you a good sweaty workout, that I feel will be really good for just keeping healthy and regularizing your cycles.
Okay, doc, that is the lifestyle modification and exercise and stuff like that. But when it comes down to medication, is there any form of medication that people can take that, you know, can help improve their problem?
So here again, for the treatment of PCOS, there are two ways of dealing with it. So if a couple wants to try to conceive, then the treatment regime is different. But if a young unmarried girl wants to just regularize her cycles, then that is a different way of treatment. So for starting off with young unmarried girls who have irregular cycles, they are first taught about this lifestyle modification, and we give them some time because we don't want to just put them on meds and immediately start off with some treatment. So we give them that sort of an information and give them an opportunity to lose weight and get into a healthy lifestyle. And then they come back like maybe after 2-3 months, if the symptoms are still persisting, then we put them on certain pills. Okay, so these are oral contraceptive pills which need to be taken every month for 21 days. There are different pills which are available in the market, and this helps in regularizing the cycles. If a couple comes to us and they want to try to conceive, then the treatment we try to put for them is different because obviously we can't put them on contraceptive pills. So they'll be trying to conceive. So we do something called ovulation induction for them, where we will be doing a follicle monitoring. We call them in regularly for doing ultrasound scans to see how the eggs are coming up. And we tell them when the eggs are mature and, when is the right time to have intercourse so that their chance of conceiving in that cycle increases. And after that, we ask them, after a period of 2 weeks, we ask them to check for urine pregnancy test to see if it's come positive. And if not, then they come for another cycle of ovulation induction.
I think this is a great segue for us to probably ask you now, what is, IUI or IVF?
Right. To keep it very simple, IUI stands for intrauterine insemination. So it's a very self-explanatory term where the husband's sample, the semen sample, is filtered and the good sperms are taken and slowly inseminated, injected into the uterus of the female partner. IVF, it's a more complicated procedure. The procedure per se starts on the second or third day of the period where the patient comes in, we do a baseline scan, and we start off with injections. Yes, you have to take injections every day. It can be very painful, but it's totally worth it for somebody who's suffered from infertility for a really long time. So we monitor the growth of the follicles. We call the patient in every 3 to 4 days. Once the follicles are noted to be mature, we plan for an oocyte retrieval procedure. For this, the patient has to come in on an empty stomach in the morning. And the procedure is done under very mild IV sedation, and the patient can go back home the same day. Once the eggs are retrieved, they will have slight amount of pain for which appropriate painkillers are given. And once the eggs are retrieved, we take the husband's semen sample and we inject the sperm into the egg, and we keep it in the media and wait for it to grow and become embryos. So there are very specific stages at which the embryo growth is monitored. So on a day zero, that's when the pickup is done and the sperm is injected. Then we see the next day, we see on day one as to how many eggs have been fertilized. And subsequently on day three, we check how many have grown. And day five is when we see the best embryos and we see the grade of those embryos, and only the best embryos are frozen. And most of the time, if we have retrieved somewhere around 10 to 15 eggs, we will be able to probably have only 3 to 4 good quality grade A embryos at the end of the procedure.
Dr. Smriti, for women out there who are resorting to going with the IVF route, there are two very, very huge concerns that they will generally have. The first one being, would these injections cause me weight gain? Can I have localized infection? What would this do to my sex drive? Is there long-term effects? That's one. And the second part is the viability of the eggs. Since we have got finite number of eggs, what is the failure rates, right? Because at day zero, when you harvest and you allow for the insemination, you keep in the media, what is the sort of failure rates that they should be looking at? I'm not sure, Dr. Smriti, if you're going to address this later on, but I think these would be pressing questions our listeners would have.
Great questions, by the way. So the injections are going to be painful. Yes, we have patients who are so scared of taking injections, and we do a little bit of counseling from our side. So it's very important to be mentally prepared for what you're going to be going through in an IVF. So I always advise the couples to not just jump into it, you know, like get so desperate that you just want to get done with IVF. No. So take some time out, understand the procedure. And we have a session, we have counseling sessions where we explain to them everything from A to Z. We tell them what's going to happen. The injections do cause a little bit of weight gain because they are hormones and they're quite high doses of hormones, but it is temporary. So after the retrieval or after the IVF cycle, the weight can be reversed and they can lose the weight. Only temporarily when they're taking the injections, they will feel maybe sometimes even a flare up of acne can happen, as well as mild amount of weight gain. The reduced sex drive. Also, during the IVF stimulation, we advise our patients not to indulge in intercourse because it can affect the egg growth and the quality. Infections, I don't think so. Very few of our patients have had any infections because of these injections. Of course, they need to maintain a good amount of local hygiene when they're taking the injections and make sure, you know, it's given in the right way by a qualified professional. Apart from this, the success rates of IVF, it all again depends on the age of the patient. You know, it's the most important criteria when it comes to the number of eggs retrieved, the quality of the eggs. But the attrition rate is much higher when it comes to an older couple than a younger couple. So to conclude, I'm just trying to say that the success rate totally depends on the age. Because of that, the AFC and the AMH vary.
Another question that comes to my mind is the side effects of IVF, where, you know, we hear that usually the pregnancy can be twins. I mean, the rate of twins in IVF is much higher. Could you throw a bit of light on that?
Okay, yes. So this, you know, boils down to the obstetric complications. So IVF pregnancies, you know, there's a myth which goes around, which is like IVF pregnancies always land up with C-sections. IVF pregnancies are always more complicated. Now, to a certain extent, it's true because of, you know, the following reasons. We all know that, you know, for a woman, as she grows older, we do know that the obstetric complications can be slightly higher. Because most of the women, after having tried to conceive for many years with multiple cycles of failures of IUI, finally, when they come to IVF, they will be somewhere around 34, 35 years of age. So the predisposition to develop diabetes in pregnancy as well as hypertension. Along with that, in India, there is no norm or no set rule in the IVF centers where they have to do a single embryo transfer. So most of the time, to improve the success rates, two embryos are transferred into the uterus. This lands up with twin gestation. And we all know that compared to a single pregnancy, twin pregnancies have higher complication rates. So that is the reason, you know, sometimes the obstetric complications can be higher in IVF pregnancies.
Okay. And do most of these IVF procedures, do they end up having cesarean sections as opposed to a normal delivery? If you could throw light on that.
So this is again a very good question. So most of the time when it comes to an IVF pregnancy, they want to have a healthy baby because they've gone through so much just to try to conceive. So the maternal request is the most common indication for a cesarean section in IVF. When we explain to the couple about the complications or, you know, how the process is of a normal delivery and what all can go wrong, they are so scared and they really don't want to take even like a 0.1% of risk when it comes to the delivery. And they opt for an elective C-section.
Dr. Smriti, now that we've spoken about IVF, IUI, what a patient goes through or what a mother goes through to conceive, what options do we have as women when it comes to preserving our oocytes? What would you recommend, you know, a couple that needs to figure things out, mothers who are not optimal health-wise, but they're at the right age to sort of harvest eggs? Is there something that we can offer them?
Yes. So for a couple who is just married, who wants to take some time to figure things out, you know, there is no need to try to conceive immediately. They have to first get their fertility assessed. So they need to get tested, like the semen analysis and the ovarian reserve. These two are very important things that they have to check for before they decide on postponing the planning or starting of a family. Now, for whatever reason, if there is some sort of a problem there, if the female partner has low ovarian reserve or less number of eggs in her ovaries, then the option of egg freezing can be given to them. Egg freezing is very similar to the IVF procedure per se, and it's exactly how it's done in an IVF. The only difference is that the embryos will be frozen with us until the couple decides that they're ready to go ahead and get the embryos transferred. This is for a married couple. On the other hand, if there is a young woman who is not still sure of whether she's going to get married or whether she wants to have kids, but again, you know, everybody knows they're sitting on a ticking clock, you know, the whole biological clock concept. So a young girl who wants to get her fertility assessed can do that. And whenever she decides to get married or when she decides to go forward and start a family, she can use the husband's semen or donor semen and make the eggs into embryos and then get these embryos transferred into her uterus to try to conceive. There is this disclaimer here is that it's very important to know that the egg thawing rate. So now when we freeze the egg, we have to thaw it. So the survival rate of eggs after being thawed is a little lesser than the survival rate of embryos because the egg has a lot of water content. It's the biggest cell in our body. So when you're thawing these, the water content can get crystallized and the eggs can get degenerated. So she may require more than one cycle of egg freezing to get good number of eggs in the storage so that they can be made into good number of embryos.
That's great. I mean, superb. So this is an option for a career woman who probably, you know, who can't get pregnant presently, but, you know, has the option for it later on.
Yes, you know, with the technology available, I think a lot of people should make use of it rather than suffering from trying to conceive and IVF and infertility at, you know, advanced age. And they should also understand one thing is that the rate of genetic abnormalities as they grow older in the baby also increases. So if they freeze their eggs at 32 or 30, they'll, you know, have the option of having healthy babies even though they have become 38 or 39 because the eggs which will be used is when she was 32. So the rate of genetic abnormalities or Down syndrome, aneuploidies in the baby will also be less. So this is a huge advantage when it comes to trying for IVF.
Dr. Smithy, would this be a good time for me to ask you about donor oocytes then? How would this differ from donor oocytes?
So donor oocyte is one of the options, again, we give for women who have low ovarian reserve. We have done maybe, you know, one or two cycles. It's not worked out. And if the couple still insists on going for their own eggs, we do tell them that the success rates are lower. But if they use the oocyte of a young woman who has donated her eggs for the purpose of helping, you know, childless couples, then the success rate again drastically increases. So from 30 to 40% for a woman whose advanced maternal age is like 38. So it goes up to like 60 to 70% with a donor oocyte. Now these donors are chosen very carefully, right? We have to make sure that they're healthy and they've already had children of their own. And we also try to match the blood group as well as certain phenotypical features. Although we cannot always guarantee like a fair donor or a very educated donor because that is the demand from some of the couples. And it's quite funny, you know, we have a lot of requests. They're like, she should be a vegetarian. I don't want a non-vegetarian donor. So we... We're quite, you know, it's difficult to match exactly everything that the couple wants in their donor. But at the end of the day, we want healthy eggs because we want a healthy embryo and a healthy baby. Ultimately, that's the goal.
I think that was really informative, Dr. Smithy. And it brings me to the last question, which I have for you, which is, and I feel like this would be an incomplete podcast if we didn't address it. So for patients who have gone through multiple cycles of IVF and who have not succeeded, you know, with all types of method, what about surrogacy? Does that have a role to play?
Yes. So surrogacy has had a major role to play in couples who have not been able to conceive, you know, with their own eggs. And, you know, the woman has had multiple embryo transfers, and they've really not been able to find out the reason for these multiple failures. But the new bill has been introduced in India recently, very recently. This was in Jan 2022, where commercial surrogacy has been completely banned and only altruistic surrogacy is allowed. Now, what this means is commercial surrogacy was a process in which there was an exchange of money for the services provided by the surrogate. And there was no real, you know, guidelines or certain rules set up as to how many times the surrogate can do this, you know, how many embryo transfers can be done for her. There was extreme amount of ambiguity when it came to surrogacy many years ago. But this has been streamlined now. And the new rules say that they allow only altruistic surrogacy, where the surrogate should be somebody known to the infertile couple and they cannot be any exchange of money. Of course, you know, there are certain other criterias that the bill has mentioned. They should have an insurance cover, which will make sure that she is, you know, covered for at least 16 months, which includes the postpartum period as well. Apart from that, the couple should have a certificate of infertility. They should have a proper letter from a fertility specialist that they have tried whatever possible. And of course, they've also mentioned a court order which needs to be there, which specifically identifies the custody of the baby once it is born. So only a couple which is Indian and been married for 5 years without any biological child or adopted child or a previous surrogate child of their own can go for altruistic surrogacy. Or if they have a child with any physical or mental issues or some sort of a terminal illness, only then they qualify. Apart from this, the male partner should be from 26 to 55 years of age and the female partner should be from 25 to 50 years of age. So there is also a very strict criteria for choosing the surrogate. She should be from 25 to 30 years of age and she should be ever married, which means she should have been married at least once with a child of her own. It can be any close family relative or even a very close friend. And she can do this only once in her lifetime.
Okay. I can only assume that, you know, we've seen a lot of instances where this practice has been misused. There were stories that, you know, Westerners would come down here and pay people for it and led to a lot of complications and some of the issues which you were talking about. I mean, who has rights over the birth of that child? So, yeah, so I know it's really complicated and there's a lot of law and stuff which is there, but the option is out there for those who really want to conceive and who have failed with IVF and IUI. And probably in another podcast, we try and clear up some of misconceptions about surrogacy and the way you can easily access it.
Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of our podcast. Dr. Smithy, thank you for doing this. This is very apt in line with International Women's Day. I think we are at that stage in our lives now where we need to speak about things that matter, and this matters. Dr. Smithy, I just want to call out three very important things that you've done for us today. You have made sure that you've given us conjoined accountability on bringing in a child into the world. You've given us fresh lens on infertility, and it's no longer lopsided. It's not always the woman. It's not always the man. It has become something that has permeated through our society, and a lot of us have misunderstood it. So firstly, thanks for that. Second, thank you for giving us options that we could think about, given that we have become a society that's very, very focused on achieving things beyond domestic bliss. And finally, the talk about surrogacy, which Ashish correctly brought up, it has been abused, misused, and it's about time there were better controls on it. So thank you for that, Dr. Smithy, for doing this very, very special episode, especially in line with International Women's Day. Thank you so much, Dr. Smithy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here. You know, this is a great platform and this opportunity you've given me to put forth my views. And I really hope this reaches out a wide audience, because all I'm trying to do here is give the information which, you know, every woman should know, which actually empowers her and gets her to make her own decisions. And, you know, it really gives me immense pleasure to be here. I'm so happy you guys are doing this and you've chosen this topic. Happy International Women's Day to all the women listeners here. Thank you so much.
With that, thank you, guys. Thanks for joining us. Please do like and subscribe. You know, your likes and subscribes makes this go a long way. And with that, we'll have Dr. Smriti's link in bio. So those who want to contact her, please do. And until the next time, bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.